I guess we can go ahead and start. I'm going to introduce myself. My name is Jennifer Ouellette. I am the new journalist in residence, and I'm thrilled you guys are coming here on a Friday afternoon. It's gorgeous out there, and I'm not sure I would be here. I'm a former English major turned into a science writer, purely by accident. Along the way, I have learned quite a lot about physics, but also about effective ways of talking not only to physicists and getting them to talk to me, because, you know, frankly, I do not have a background, so it often becomes an exercise in translation. I actually do have a clip that I'd like to show that kind of illustrates a little bit of the problem that most of us have when we don't come. Many of you have probably seen this.
Next thing you know, I'm up in the car, breaking the window.
Yeah. But, you know, you're deeper than that. Like, I know you're into a lot of reading. What are you reading these days? What are you studying? What are you into?
I gotta tell you, I absolutely love reading. I'm a huge reader. And when I pick up something, I just can't put it down, you know? Like quantum physics, that's my favorite.
Quantum physics?
Yeah.
What are you talking about? Quantum physics?
Well, I was just reading this incredible paper on the stochastic phase shifting of a parametrically driven electron in a Penning trap. And apparently, a bistability arises dynamically in this specific parametrically driven systems because the phase psi of the electron's steady state oscillation can either have the two values separated by pi.
Yeah, that's crazy. You know, that was amazing. You know, you shot. What shocks me about an electron in a Penning trap is that most amplitude collapses are accompanied by a phase flip. Given that the rate of escape from an attractor depends exponentially upon an activation energy E as the diffusion constant D approaches T sub N, and rho approaches epsilon with a negative E over D.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I know. It's like,
no question.
We talked about it.
Of course.
Yeah.
It's a no-brainer.
Conan,
I don't know about that, Conan. Have you considered that the parametric driving force excites a nearly resonant electron oscillation at the drive frequency? Omega sub d over 3 equals omega sub z plus epsilon. It's a classic example of the period doubling that occurs when a linear oscillator is strongly driven.
Did you just say that the omega sub d over 3 equals omega sub z plus epsilon?
Yeah.
Whoa. It's actually omega sub d over 2 equals omega sub z plus epsilon. Wow, Max. Max, you know nothing about quantum physics.
You're right.
It's lonely over here. Lonely,
it certainly
man.
Is. All right.
I've been here for 2 weeks. I don't know. It's funny. Actually, Jim Carrey is quoting from a paper by Jerry Gabrielides, obviously. And Jerry actually shows this occasionally at his talks. He's just so thrilled that one of his papers, you know, was on Conan. It's just dead on, and I've been here for 2 weeks, and I've actually been going to the talks, and I'm watching these arguments going on, and I'm watching you guys kind of challenge each other, and occasionally there's a little bit of a, can you believe this guy, and you know, what I really loved was they just got the dynamics down, you know, and I think it captures the problem very, very perfectly. So,
by way of counterpoint, just to toss it out for advertising. Peter Fisher from MIT was on
yes.
a couple nights ago.
Actually, it's on my next slide. we are going to be talking a little bit about that. But anyway, this is a famous Sid Harris cartoon that I usually have because this is kind of what you sound like to the rest of us. now, of course, I was telling my husband's a cosmologist, and I was basically telling him, you know, about my first week. Was why are you going to the lectures? You have no hope of understanding them. Well, I says, yes, that's true. But in fact, I actually got quite a bit out of going to the lectures. I kind of looked at how the physicists were interacting with each other. I got a real sense of the lay of the land. I was generally, because I've been doing this long enough and because my husband tells me about his work, to kind of get the gist. I could get the overgist and I could probably get a couple points and then I could go back and try and figure stuff out. That's going to form the basis for the second part of this talk, and we want to get a little bit more interactive. I'll tell you what I've come up with so far, and then hopefully there'll be enough physicists here that can help us flesh out the details of things like, you know, the preheating or the reheating phase of the inflationary model and where parametric residence might play a role. But the point is, I was watching body language, I was watching delivery styles, I was watching dynamics between the speaker and the audience, among other things. And that's because communication isn't just about what you say, what's on your PowerPoint slides, it's also about how you're saying it. Body language is actually very important. Your eye contact or lack thereof, whether you're standing like this, whether you're comfortable or nervous, or whether you're kind of mumbling and looking down and constantly fiddling with your PowerPoint slides, all of this can actually get in the way of effective communication. It's all about connecting with your audience, and without that kind of connection, there can be no real communication, and I think that is part of the biggest problem we have today. There is a huge, huge knowledge gap between PhD physicists, the average member of the public. You're lucky if you get someone like me who actually understands some of the jargon, who's taken some time to learn some basic physics, who writes about it, who interacts with physicists. I'm a lot more willing to work with you, meet you halfway, and bang my head against the wall till I get something. It's a lot harder for the average person on the street. And yet it's very, very important. So I was looking at all those intangibles and trying to think of useful ways that I could find to kind of help all of us really work on some of the things to make us better at connecting, not just with the layperson, with each other, with people in other disciplines, because there are lots of different levels and ways of speaking to different audiences, and you kind of have to know who your audience is before you can even connect with them. So, okay. Next slide. Physics, of course, as we have seen, faces that unique challenge. Tell us in layman's terms what your breakthrough means, and you know, your idea of layman's terms and my idea of layman's terms are very, very different. I had at least one conversation this past week with a guy who says, "Let me explain my work to you in plain English," and he proceeded to just go on for 30 minutes, and I had to keep stopping him and saying, "I don't know what this is." And you keep saying this, and I think you're saying this, but I understand it in these terms, and you know, is it a way to, you know, can we bring this down a level? So this is a very, very big problem. From my perspective, as a science writer, former English major, no degree in physics, the kinds of things that you're doing here at the KITP, the level of research, the abstract theory, it's about as hard as it gets when it comes to communicating science. I'm relishing the challenge. I'm really looking forward to working with everyone to kind of help me with my understanding, and then working with you, and maybe together we can find really new effective ways to get the public to really not only care, because I think that there is a lot of natural interest in science, as we've seen, but also to find better ways that they can actually understand, not just laugh at the jokes, but actually say, well, actually, I think I understand a little bit of what he said there, and that's interesting, and I might want to learn more about that. The public is very interested in science. I think we have this idea that they just don't care, and there may be a small percentage of the population that doesn't care. It's probably about the same percentage of the population that still thinks the Bush administration is doing a heck of a job. You can't reach a certain fraction of people, not because they're stupid, but because they don't want to learn. They don't wish to be reached, they don't want to be challenged. Fine. That still leaves us with a good 50% there in the middle that are interested. You mentioned Peter Fisher on Conan O'Brien. It was a great clip. He basically brought on Peter Fisher, and they tried to figure out how long his wedding ring would spin on the top of the desk. Lisa Randall this week was also on the Cobell Report. Jim Carrey has been previously on Conan O'Brien. He actually did a bit where he got Stephen Hawking to tape a fake telephone call where they actually talked about, you know, an alternative cosmological model. It was very, very nice that Hawking played along. The public loves it when scientists show their human side, when they show their sense of humor, when they agree to engage in something that might be a little silly. I guess if you're Hawking's stature, you just don't care. And you kind of don't mind being on Conan O'Brien in a skit with Jim Carrey. There was a joke in there about that he had to go back and watch Dumb and Dumber. Also, if you look at the major network shows in the top 10, the Nielsen ratings, week after week, they're all about science. They're not necessarily about physics. You've got forensics with CSI, with Bones, which is more forensic anthropology. You've got Numbers, which I think pulls in something like 12 million viewers every Friday night, which uses math to solve crimes. Essentially, you've got two brothers, one's an FBI agent, one's a genius mathematician. You've got a new sitcom, The Big Bang Theory, that actually the physicists are the main characters. And then you've got more cable-oriented shows like Mythbusters. That's probably the top-rated show on the Discovery Channel. So what I'm hoping to make clear here is that it really is about how you connect with the audience. It's not that they don't care. It's not that they don't have an interest. It's that they just can't understand in the same way that you can. So physicists, unfortunately, have to do a lot of extra work. They have to kind of meet them halfway, and depending on what level they're at, sometimes you got to work do a little extra and maybe meet them a little more than halfway. When Lisa Randall, when Stephen Hawking, and all these people appear on these major network television shows, they're doing all of us a great service because they are letting us see into their world in a very friendly and accessible way. Because your world can be kind of scary if you're not familiar with it. It can be very intimidating. So what I want to do over the next 10 weeks, I basically have a series of things that I've planned. I know the membership here shifts and people come and go, so not everyone's going to be here for everything. But I thought I'd give you sort of a preview. I am a blogger. I have a blog called Cocktail Party Physics. So next week we're going to be talking about the ins and outs of science blogging. There are a few physicists who blog. Not nearly as many as you might think. It's a tremendous new format. It can be very, very useful. There are pitfalls, and we're going to be talking a little bit about all of those. The following week, press conference protocol. I don't know how many of you have gone to scientific meetings to give a paper and had the PI person call you up and say, yeah, we want to organize, you know, a little press conference with some media members so you can explain the work to them. And there are varying degrees of success at doing that. I've gone to a lot of APS meetings in particular where the only people who understood the press conferences were the people who wrote for Science and Nature. And I would look at the person from the local newspaper and they'd just be like, you know. And invariably they would raise their hand and go, why? Why should we care? So, you know, I don't understand. I don't get it. So we're going to be running through mock press conferences. We're going to be going through some handy tips. I know a lot of press conference kind of people, and they are sending me a bunch of the tips that they use to help train their scientists. And we are basically going to have a few journalistic types here playing journalists and asking you questions while you try and explain your research. And because I believe that good communication, I can sit up here and talk to you all I want. That's not going to help you become a better communicator. You've got to actually get in the trenches and start doing it. A lot of what I'm going to be doing is going to be very, very interactive, and so I'm kind of hoping that as people get more comfortable that you all will participate. I'm very excited about March 7th. This is called Inside the Writer's Room. We're going to have a couple of very special guests. UCLA physicist David Salzberg. He's the technical consultant on the Big Bang Theory. And we have a TV writer, David Gray, who's done Joan of Arcadia and the Gilmore Girls. They're going to come up. They're going to talk about the interplay between what it's like to be a physicist on a TV set and how they talk to each other and what role each plays. And then we're going to actually have a mock writer's room. David Gray will be the showrunner, and we're going to brainstorm and try and come up with an idea for a physics-centric TV series. Who knows? Something might come out of that. Next week, the week after that, the Art of the Book deal. We'll be talking about what makes a good book proposal, what makes a promising science, popular science book, what editors are looking for. If you're at all interested in that, this would be the time to come. March 21st, a panel discussion. I know a lot of you have some issues with how science is covered in the press. Many of those are valid. Many of those arise from a misunderstanding of between the two cultures, between the two worlds. So we're going to be bringing up some journalists, some science writers, and also a couple of physicists who are quite media savvy, and they'll just be a kind of freewheeling discussion for an hour and a half where people can vent, people can present both sides of the story, and we can maybe come up with some ideas to kind of reduce that tension a little bit. March 28th, very interactive again, interview with the physicist, where we will have, we'll basically be videotaping one-on-one interviews, and we will play them back. And it's very, very helpful, I find, I've only done this a few times, and it's shocking whenever I see myself on camera, because you just don't understand. You don't really understand that the way you're sitting really does convey something that you don't may not need to attend transmit. I found the first time I did this that I was kind of doing this and sitting back, and I was kind of playing with my hair and looking off, and it doesn't work. When you're doing TV stuff, you've got to look in the camera, and you've got to connect, and you've got to really kind of, it's embarrassing. You feel like you're, you know, in a pep squad, and they're telling you to, like, be a cheerleader, but in fact, to be effective on camera, you kind of need to up it a notch in terms of your energy level, and you need to be very aware of what you're doing with your body. So that, I think, will be very important. The next one is going to be very, very threatening. We're going to bring in a drama coach, an actor, to run us through improv exercises. Alan Alda did this at the University of Southern California a few weeks ago, and it was the most threatening thing I've ever done. For someone like me, who's fairly shy and retiring, I'm a writer, I like to, like, lock myself up in my room. It's extremely threatening to have to, like, go through all these bizarre exercises. And halfway through, we're kind of wondering why. Well, what good could this possibly do? But the difference in the before and after of the engineering students' presentations was astounding. And I talked to Alda afterwards, and he explained that a lot of times you're so cerebral and you're so locked up in your head. He said it really helped him, because he's a very smart man. He is very cerebral. It helped him kind of connect again with his body and be more aware, and also to learn how to read other people. Another good part of communication is watching your listeners' reaction. We're not all very good at that. We tend to be focused on what we're saying, particularly if you're a physicist and you're in didactic mode. You're used to teaching, you're used to lecturing. You go into lecture mode. People's eyes tend to glaze over within about 10 minutes of that. It's unfair, but it's true. So that's what this is meant to address. It's an unusual way of doing it, and he did warn me not to try and do it myself. He says, you know, you really kind of have to get someone in there who knows method acting and who knows the improv exercises. So we'll be hooking up with the theater department here at KITP to do that. April 18th, we're calling it PowerPoint karaoke, but there is no singing. this is focusing on interdisciplinary communication, which is something that I think is very important to the KITP. From what I've been seeing, you know, in the programs, the talks I've heard this past couple weeks, you're bringing in people who are kind of in related fields so they can explore the overlapping areas. It's been very interesting for me because I've been watching these lectures and finding that the communication gap is very, very real, even at the PhD level. I'm finding that they're having to redefine terms in a different framework. If you've got a strongly coupled system versus a weakly coupled system, the dynamics are going to be completely different, and what you think you understand one way works differently here. So there's a lot of clarification that was going on, which is why I was attending these talks. I wanted to get an idea of those kinds of dynamics. And April 25th will be my last day here, so we're going to have basically a talk about, I'm calling it Mythbusters, because I think that the whole idea of the C.P. Snow two cultures is crap. I think it's an artificial divide, and Tony Z has agreed to be a member of a panel discussion on things like finding the symmetries, finding the connections between science and art and literature and all these things, and rather than focusing on how they differ and on the divide, focusing on what they have in common, on how, what, you know, creativity works in a much the same way in physics as it does, say, in art. Particularly with between math and art, or physics and art, and math and music. These are all places where you have some very nice synergies. So I think it'll be a very interesting, again, freewheeling panel discussion. Now, that's all over the place, but there's a method to my madness. the whole point is that in this day and age, it's not just about print. It's not just about books. There's an increasingly diverse type of media formats. Lots of different areas. You've got on the web, you've got print, you've got TV, you've got radio. And there's all different kinds. You've got blogs, you've got websites, you've got YouTube, you've got podcasts. And there's also a general trend towards integrating them more and more. So we have to be as flexible and adaptable as possible in how we communicate the science. The message has to fit the format, and the format in this day and age is constantly changing. I'm frequently, more and more, being asked not just to write an article or to be interviewed on TV, but also to provide a few background squibs on the science behind the, they want links, they want all these various things, because they are trying to make everything more interactive. I think in the long run that's a very, very good thing. I think that it will help solve part of the problem of space limitations in science stories. A lot of times they leave out some crucial details. If you can do a hyperlink for more information, if you can have like a definition pop up while they're reading in some of those active menus, it takes a while for users to get used to those, but it is a way of linking all these various resources together in one integrated whole. The problem is that it makes the communication aspect extremely difficult. And that is the subject of today's talk. I'm done with the introductory stuff now. There is one common element to all of these: the need for a strong and compelling core narrative. This is a painting, 1870, by Sir John Everett Millais. That is supposed to be the young Sir Walter Raleigh and his brother, and they're listening in rapt fascination to him tell stories of seafaring adventures. And as you know, Raleigh became one of the foremost explorers of Elizabethan England. That's the power of a really good story that can capture the imagination. It can inspire people with what they want to do in their lives. I've talked to a lot of physicists over the years, and many of them fell in love with physics by reading a book, by a science fiction book, by, you know, knowing someone, meeting a famous physicist who told them stories about their research. More and more it's science fiction, TV, and movies. But there's something about that ignites their imagination and makes them say, hey, maybe I can be that. Maybe I can do that. And once you do that, they're much more willing to buckle down and do the tough stuff. This is not about glossing over the fact that it's hard. It's getting them excited and inspired enough, because if a kid is really, really interested, he'll go and learn everything about dinosaurs, but he'll be completely bored if you try and teach him about rocks. That's the difference there. Stories, basically, the best of those tap into what I think sometimes they call narratives when you talk to mythologists. There's like these archetypal core story arcs that have a very, very broad appeal to the human imagination. Most ancient myths use a lot of these archetypes. If any of you are familiar with Joseph Campbell's The Voyage of the Hero, he explores many of those, the common elements in myths and stories from all over the world, throughout the ages, in all cultures. It's also one of the reasons that the Harry Potter books were so hugely successful. I was talking to a friend of mine after about the fourth one, and she goes, could she fit any more classical mythological archetypes in here? She basically took every single major one and poured it all into one thing, and she is quite possibly one of the richest writers ever. So do not underestimate the power of those core narratives. Science has stories too, and they're great stories. Once I figured out that science was not a boring kind of classroom thing where you had to like do equations and just do these, you know, watch a ball roll down an inclined plane and all these various things, but in fact there were stories, there were people, there were personalities. It was about discovery and excitement, there were problems. It's about people going, looking at something saying, why does that happen? And then sitting down and trying to figure out how that works. The catch is finding out what the underlying core narrative of your research is when you're trying to talk about it to someone else. Once you have that, and it's very, very basic, once you have that, you can add layers and layers of details as needed to suit whatever format or target audience you wish. It's really all about degree of technical difficulty. If you're talking to a colleague, you can actually add a whole lot more layers of detail. You can build this whole rich, complex tapestry depending on how sophisticated your listener is. If you're talking to someone from USA Today or you're appearing on the Colbert Report, you want to keep it short, snappy. You want to focus mostly on the core narrative with just a few minor details, because anything else, you will lose your audience and you'll also lose the power of the push of your narrative. And I want to point out, even if you have absolutely no interest in ever communicating with the media, if you think it's pointless, if you think that you want to just focus on your research, fine. Good communication skills will actually help you in your professional life, because it will help the same skills that you're going to use to be talking to the media you will use to communicate better with your fellow physicists. You'll be giving better talk presentations, you'll be talking better to people from other fields. It's never, never wasted whether or not you ever want to be a media pundit or not. So, how do we find that core narrative? I wrote a piece for Symmetry Magazine, I think last year, the year before, called Beginner's Mind, where I talked about one of the reasons I think it's very, very difficult when I go talk to physicists. I don't really know anything about their research, and so I tend to ask a broad, open-ended question. So, what do you do? The problem with that is that you're in the middle of the story. You've been following it for years and years and years. you kind of begin in medias res. You kind of begin right in the middle. And it's kind of like if you try to follow Battlestar Galactica 7 seasons in, it's just extremely difficult to catch up, to really understand what's going on. You're missing all the nuances. You're missing all the in-jokes. You have no idea what's gone before and how everything builds before it. So it's very, very useful when you know you're talking to a complete neophyte, and if they're honest, they will be very, very open with how little they know, to remember what it was like not to know. I got a black belt in jiu-jitsu several years ago now. Went through this really grueling test, and I'm sitting there bleeding with a fractured elbow. And before they tied the black belt on, they made me put my beginner's white belt on again, stand in front of the mirror, and look at myself. And they basically just said, now we want you to think back to the first day you stepped on the mat, how nervous you were, how stupid you felt, how little you knew, because you need to remember that every time you step on the mat to teach. That we all start at this very, very basic point. Every single physicist or person in this room started knowing nothing and learning accordingly. And you kind of have to remember what it was like not to know and to try and basically see it from their viewpoint. Once you do that, it becomes a little easier to do what I call practicing creative reductionism, where you boil everything down pretty much to just the most basic critical elements. It's a skill. Depending on how complex the topic is, and the stuff we're dealing with here is extremely complicated, I have to go through several iterations. I have to write it all out, go through, underline things, write it out again, and each time I go through it, I strip away a little bit more and a little bit more until I find, the ultimate core. It can be very, very hard, but it works beautifully when you do it. I also want to point out that this is not dumbing down. It's a criticism that I think is frequently applied to this approach. I prefer to think of it more as finding your E equals MC squared. Reductionism is very, very central to physics. The power of physics comes because you can take a complex phenomenon like gravity and you can boil it down to a series of equations that kind of sum it up beautifully and can be applied in lots of different concepts. You have this kind of universal element there. It's the same thing when you're building a narrative. You find those core elements, you find those basic equations, and then you can use those lots and lots of different places and in lots of different ways. It's a universal kind of element. And it's an ongoing process. I was actually surprised when I was writing my first book to learn that Maxwell's equations for electromagnetism, there were initially 20 of them. And then about 20 years after he came up with them, a guy named Oliver Heaviside actually is the one who boiled them down to the four we know and love and use today. So I want you to try and get into your heads that I'm not talking about being, taking out all the detail. I'm talking basically about finding that core powerful element, because in the same way that your core equations drive your physics and you've got all these complex things happening around it, your core narrative is what's going to drive your story and what's going to hold your audience. So, case studies. The non-equilibrium dynamics program has been going on. It's kind of in its last weeks. I went to a lot of the talks on that one because I got interested early on this notion of that pole heating or reheating phase after inflation, in that inflationary cosmological model. You can tell that I'm not familiar with the topic. Pay attention to how I'm talking about that, because you're going to be filling me in on some of the details as we go on to try and help me understand better. But I was able to at least go to these talks and talk to a few people afterwards to kind of get an idea of at least the gist, and to kind of get a story framework that I could work with. So I have that framework lined up, and I'll spell it out for you, and then you're all going to help me fill in the details. I picked this because I heard Jürgen Berges give a talk. It was one of the third or fourth talks I heard. This is what captures people's attention, which is why I'm talking about this. He's a very good speaker. Of course, he was speaking to his colleagues, so it was way over my head. But halfway through, he used the term parametric resonance. I like acoustics. I recognize the term of resonance. And I liked the way he was using it as a possible mechanism for this. And he stopped a moment and he pulled out like a watch on a chain and said, well, it's kind of like this. And he did this parabolic motion thing. It's a classical oscillator is what he called it. And that's at the end of it, you'd get this slight little kick. So gradually the resonance would build up and build up and you'd get, and I could see that because I know about, in classical physics, I know about forced oscillation resonance and how these things can build up and build up until they're powerful. And my husband used the example of the Tacoma Narrows Bridge disaster. He says, think of the bridge, it's all nicely constructed, and those are like the scalar fields, you know, and then it just starts to vibrate more and more and more, and it crumbles into all these pieces, and those pieces become the particles and radiation of the early universe. And right there's your story. Once you have that element, I knew I could work with this. So that is just some insight into how people like me think when we hear you talk. I mean, that was not the subject of his talk at all. It was a small element of it. He was actually kind of addressing similarities between the inflationary physics of the universe and some of the Rick Lab experiments and looking for areas of overlap. But when I go to these things, I'm looking for an interesting angle to draw people into the story. And that little pendulum motion and the Tacoma Bridge analogy, people can visualize that. You're dealing with some very, very abstract, highly mathematical things here, and it's extremely difficult to get those of us who don't think abstractly to think about that. But that worked for me. So that's where we're going to start. What are the core elements? When I was thinking about this during the course of the week, I thought, well, you know, the underlying story, the context here is very, very simple. That's the reason why this is such a good thing to start with, because the public loves the idea of the Big Bang and the whole birth of the universe and that sort of thing. What makes this particular angle unique is that when I looked at some popular accounts, when I Googled it, your basic standard pop science accounts of the inflationary model, they tended to skip over the reheating phase. You know, it's kind of like, then a miracle occurred, and then we move on. It's like, you know. So it's something that has not been covered a lot, and from the scientists I was talking to during the week, it became very clear that this is an area that in the last 10 years or so in cosmology, they're really starting to look a lot more closely at. It's no longer just about what was the maximum temperature of the universe and just measuring that. It's about this might be able to help us explore lots of other interesting questions in other areas as well. So that gave me a context, an interesting angle. It also gave me, you know, it's a little bit of a something new there, something different to kind of hang a narrative on. So our protagonist is the universe itself. It's kind of like the little cosmos that could. So you can start out with once upon a time there was a quantum singularity or quantum fluctuation. And you've also got some familiar story arcs here. Remember I was talking about those narratives and those mythological archetypes. You can approach this in lots of different ways, but you've got elements of your classic origin story and the kind of coming and the average, you know, coming of age archetype, the whole hero becoming empowered, the whole kind of thing. Batman Begins was playing on TV last night, and I realized that that's your typical, you know, origin story, the hero becoming who he is, and I just replaced the universe, you know, with Batman, and you've got, you know, your kind of archetype there. Lawrence Krauss did this in a popular science book he wrote called Atom, where he essentially took a hydrogen atom, and he personified the hydrogen atom, and then he followed it through the evolution of the universe, just that one single atom. You know, and the lots of various forms it took and the different roles it's played and how it appeared in all these various aspects. It was a very, very a stunning piece of science writing. It really just made me see the universe and see atoms in a whole new way. We would all be so lucky to come up with something that good. And there's a central conflict. You hear this all the time from science writers. They talk about the mystery. But in fact, that's what science is. You're solving mysteries. So it is the easiest approach to take to this. There are lots of other different ways of building the story. We're going to use the mystery because it's easy, it's obvious, and it fits. So in this case, what is the mechanism that caused this key transitional phase and gave rise to the particles and radiation of the universe? And you can work with me on fleshing out the details on that because, as I said, I mean, I kind of had to wing it based on what I could glean from the talks. I did briefly consider a different model, I mean, because I talked to a couple people who were working on an alternative model to paramagnetic resonance called tachyonic resonance. Whenever you have those two competing ideas, you can kind of do the Clash of the Titans thing. I'm a little leery of doing that, many of you remember the String Wars. It plays too easily into the media's propensity to hype. There's this little element of fight, fight, you know, and everybody just kind of wants to watch you guys beat the crap out of each other. it can be done beautifully, you know, in the same way that you can explore a complex relationship in a novel, but chances are you will play right into the hype machine, and I would like to avoid that. So, especially on very technical stuff, exactly, because I think that this is hard enough that we don't want to add this other complicated element. There's a whole lot of extra details to the story, and I was basically trying to winnow down the basic elements here. And again, when you bring in the alternative model, you're just going to confuse people because they've spent all this time following you and working really hard to figure out what parametric resonance is and why it's significant. And then you say, oh, and by the way, you know, here's this other character I forgot to mention. So for simplicity's sake, when we're dealing with this highly technical topic and very abstract, I wanted to keep it just the focused on this whole parametric resonance thing. So we have a suspect, parametric resonance. We have clues. We have a data and observations to date. And we have some constraints, the laws of physics and the prevailing body of knowledge. This is one of my favorite things. There's a lot of actually LOL cat science things out there, and I collect them because they're hysterical. I want to bring up a little bit this idea of constraints, because constraints are extremely important even when you're creating a fictional universe. Because you can't just snap your fingers and do anything and have it be believable. You won't have any conflict, there won't be any change, there won't be any arc. This came up when I was writing The Physics of the Buffyverse, where I explored the science of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And a lot of physicists were very skeptical that I could even do it. And I basically took that as a challenge. But they basically said, well, it's a magic universe. You know, magic explains everything. You just snap your fingers and it's magic. And they hadn't clearly watched the show, because in fact, the magic in the series has rules. The writers very, very quickly realized that if people could just snap their fingers and do anything, it would be boring. So they imposed rules, and those rules actually were based on energy conservation and the laws of thermodynamics. So my whole chapter on that was called The Thermodynamics of Magic.
Can I interrupt?
Yeah.
I'm sort of slow by a few beats, but referring to the earlier transcription when we talked about the story arc.
Yes.
And what Eric tells it. I was reminded of some children's science book I read when I was little. And they were all like, the one I actually remember, but I've forgotten all the other ones. The story of the little raindrop, of the little water drop.
Yeah.
It followed sort of the story of the little water drop. And he's wandering around, and suddenly he felt this pull, and he goes up into the sky, and he comes out of this cloud. I always thought one could write something like that.
Oh, it's charming. I'm not familiar with that story. I know that Edward Abbott's Flatland is the most famous example of exploring the notion of extra dimensions through a story form. Mr. Tompkins book. My husband loved 1, 2, 3 Infinity,
right,
among other things. And these are all things that did not make it into my early education, so I've started reading those now through Sean, because he's been introducing me to them. And it's wonderful. That's exactly what we're talking about. And you know, you remember that after all these years. And there are lots of people who read these books and decided to become physicists, and that's what we're talking about here. That's why this is so crucial and so important, and why I chose it for the topic of my first.
One thing I remember about 1, 2, 3 Infinity is the pirate story.
Can you tell me? I'd actually like to hear the pirate story if we have time. Maybe you can tell me afterwards. I think I clearly have to read that. So, we have our core narrative. There we go. Now, of course, this is just the bare bones framework. It's not sufficient, even for a short news story. It's missing some very, very crucial details. So, but this is the engine that will drive our story. And now that we've got the engine, now that we've got kind of the basic components that make a good story, we can start fleshing out the details. And we can include as much or as little as is suitable for who we're talking to or who we're trying to appeal to. If you're dealing with a very educated, sophisticated, technical audience, you can add a whole lot more. You can just go whole hog. It's the difference between, you know, Salman Rushdie high literature and, say, you know, Arakan romance. But they both play a role. They're both types of storytelling. So now we can start adding layers of complexity. Sid Harris is a great man. remember I was saying that I kept seeing people in the popular accounts just kind of skipping over that whole phase, you know, that we're talking about here, where that involves parametric resonance. It reminded me of this cartoon, because a lot of the things just, yeah, well, and then this kind of stuff happens, and we're not sure how or why, but it's probably not significant, and we want to get to the good stuff. But as has become apparent in the last 10 years, that actually you kind of need to be a little bit more explicit there in step two. So, the devil is in the details. I don't know if you guys saw this Onion article. It was very satirical. It was basically called "Scientists Ask Congress to Fund $50 Billion Science Thing." This is what people hear when they're listening to a technical talk. And they had this diagram. I really highly encourage you guys to look this up, because it's just like, you know, there's two glowing yellow particle things, and then, you know, what happens when good science occurs? And they didn't know what to say. They said, well, they're the same color as the other particles, so yay. You've got, you know, a science circle and another part, and maybe some isotopes or something there in the middle. They're not really sure. And pardon?
But it's always been compared to the human.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just dead on. So it's like, we explain the inner workings of the complex, expensive science thing. And for LHC people, this is going to be particularly relevant, because this is what they have to deal with all the time. I mean, I actually think that the LHC community has done a fantastic job of getting their basic story out. CERN has an excellent website with some lay language interpretations and diagrams of the LHC. And I would love more people to be aware of that. I always tell lay audiences to check those things out and include links whenever I can, because there is some very, very good stuff out there. It's dead-on satire. From a journalist perspective, I'm going to actually, the accompanying news story just followed the straight news story format, except that it had all these funny aspects. Where they basically left out all the details. It was essentially the work of an extremely lazy reporter. Yes, a few sample satirical quotes. According to the scientists, the electromagnetic science maker will make atoms move and spin around very quickly. And the scientists, the congressman says, well, they appeared very smart sounding and confident that their big spinner would solve some kind of problem they described. And my personal favorite, in making fun of some of the charts and diagrams that show, that means something to all of you, but we just like, it's squiggly lines and dots. And another diagram presented to lawmakers contained several important squiggly lines, numbers, and letters. Despite not being numbers, the letters were reportedly meant to represent mathematics. The scientists seemed to believe that correct math would make the science thing go. I like that for just so many other reasons. So the Onion article didn't explain enough. Of course, more often than not, we have the opposite problem of scientists attempting to explain too much, far more detail than is necessary. There's only so much detail that the average person can grasp in a single sitting before their brain shuts down and they just can't absorb anymore. That's why we have this need for the core narrative. And also, you know, scientists love to explore these minor technical points. I was watching it happen in the lectures all here. So, you know, I realize this isn't really related to your main point, but this equation over here, I'm very interested by this element, and, you know, I don't agree with that, and can you explain that? And there was one guy who was supposed to give a short, like, hour-long talk, and it went to 2 hours because he had to stop every time and explain. People kept interrupting, which is great for what you do here, because that's exactly why you're here. When you're talking to someone else and you actually want to tell a story, leave that stuff out, because pacing is everything. And I'm going to give you another funny example of why pacing is everything. This is an XKCD cartoon making fun of the whole centrifugal versus centripetal force debate with James Bond. Come now, do you really expect me to do coordinate substitution with my head while strapped to a centrifuge? And if you were going to have this conversation happen in a James Bond movie, it would just kill the action. It might work in Austin Powers, just because it's not really about action at that point. I'm going to actually exit here briefly, because there is one more clip that I want to show. And I have it bookmarked so that we can be very easy on the web. You guys guys have a great connection here. And here it is.
But first up, books. Currently number one on the New York Times bestseller list is the Albert Einstein biography, Einstein, His Life and Universe. Don't try to tell me about all the contributions he made to human knowledge. Relativity is just science's way of flip-flopping. Space or time, mass or energy, which is it? Pick a side, we're at war. And I'm sorry, E equals MC squared. C does not stand for the speed of light. C is for cookie, and that's good enough for me. If you don't like it, you can take it up with Professor Monster.
Oh, cookie, cookie, cookie's touch with C.
Oh, and by the way, Al, get a haircut. Something timeless, yet classy. Much better. Makes me look smart.
Yeah. Well, he needs something to make him look smart. So, Stephen Colbert is one of the most science-friendly people that we are likely to find. And I'm so thrilled. He's got scientists on there all the time. He's had Lisa Randall, as we saw. He has Neil deGrasse Tyson on all the time. It's very nice to see him working in these in-jokes for very smart, savvy people. It can't be bad for science to have something like that. So, I did actually show that for a point. Pay attention, particularly when you're listening to me try and figure out the details of all these various things, to how we misunderstand. There's probably no hope for Stephen Colbert, you know, but if you look at how I'm misunderstanding things, you know, it can give you insight into how to better tailor your message. Where are people getting hung up on your story? That'll give you an idea that maybe you're using the wrong terminology, maybe you've inadvertently used some technical jargon or a concept that, a word that they're familiar in the real world thing that means something completely different in physics. I found that when I was writing these popular science books that if I used the word work or force, I had to be very, very careful because it means one thing to the average person and something very, very specific in physics, and thank God for the footnote. We've already talked about avoiding the unnecessary tangents. These are handy tips basically when we enter the discussion phase, which is coming up next, because I actually do want your input on how to flesh out this parametric resonance story. Hopefully there's at least a few people here who know about that. I know David does. It hijacks the narrative flow. Eschew the obfuscation. That is something they taught me in my 101 journalism class. It used to be a bumper sticker, which basically just says, don't use the 10-cent word when you can use something really basic and straightforward. That can get a little taken to extremes. I don't agree with the tendency to write at an eighth grade level in the major newspapers. That might just be because I'm a word person. But I think that people actually can grasp meaning in context, and I know that I learned my vocabulary by sometimes reading things that were a little bit beyond me, but eventually I began to kind of grasp and put things together and realize. So you want to find a balance. You don't want to use the big Latinate 10-cent words. You don't want to use a lot of jargon, but you don't also want to be cookie starts with C kind of thing. So every time you use a technical term, you must define it in plain English. You can, if you have a lot of space, or if you have time, you can actually maybe come up with a summation of something. Tom Levison teaches science communication at MIT, and one of the first things he does in his class is to talk to the scientists and basically say, okay, your first assignment is to pick one term, one technical term from your field, and sum it up in 100 words. Because that's how much space you're going to have to explain it in the context of as background in an average newspaper article. And it's incredibly hard. And it's extremely instructive for them to realize just what, you know, they're up against, you know, and what journalists have to deal with every day. Embrace analogy and metaphor. It's tough to do this well. We've all seen the damage that can be done by a really sloppy or not so good metaphor or analogy. But it's worth trying, because the potential payoff is huge. My attitude here is I would rather at least try an analogy and have it fall flat on its face, but at least I tried, and it might give me an idea to come up with another one. It might, you know, start the ball rolling. So when we're talking about parametric resonance, you know, that analogy that Jürgen used is what made me go, oh, that, I get that, I can work with this. that's the attitude, that's what you want to evoke in your listener, because then we want to know more. So.
Also, they remember it better, too.
Oh, sure. I always remember things better if there's a story behind it or if there's something I can visualize. It just, it sticks in my brain in a way that a simple, dry, technical definition won't.
Most people haven't done that before.
Yeah.
Most people have done it. It's much like a child in the swing. Mm-hmm. There you're in with the same frequency as the child, and you're pushing the velocity of the world.
Right.
Too hard,
right. Actually, that's actually. The one thing that hung me up on the watch was he was saying we understand pendulums a little bit, but that extra kick, and that's something that I didn't quite get. Where that extra kick is coming from? Because I'm kind of thinking, doesn't it kind of run down? It's
in the case of the child on the swing. The child is raising and lowering where they're located on the swing.
That's how they're swinging.
No, not when
you're adding energy to the system.
The way that a kick gets a swing ball decreases.
Yeah, that's the real parametric. That's the other thing that's driven at the same frequency. When you're pushing a kid, you're simply timing to give a push at the right time.
Okay.
It's
so
not parametric resonance at all.
This is excellent. It's excellent because I want to stop here and go to this because you're pushing at the same frequency. Where does the energy for that push come from?
Your arm.
No, I'm talking about in the universe when it comes to parametric resonance. I know where it's coming from. Everything comes from the implanton. I don't even know what the implanton is. When I first saw that in the lecture notes, I thought, is that a typo? But I did talk to a couple of people, and they were talking to me about the implanton. So that was actually a big help. So that's the kind of thing we're talking about.
That's why it's not forced resonance, which is pushing a kid on a swing.
Uh-huh.
There's no outside force that can be in resonance.
That's
right, and with the frequency that you need. So it has to be something like parametric resonance.
Okay. What was this?
You said that the kid pumping the legs.
The kid pumping the legs is an internal effect, and that's what you're looking for. The universe has to pump itself up.
This is great.
Well, parametric resonance occurs because you have two different components of the universe.
That's true.
Which are coupled, and just like you and the.
That's true.
And that's good too, because one of the things that I was finding, you kept talking about strongly and weakly coupled, and that's not something that really means something to someone like me. That I am coupled to the kid on the swing, and that we form a system, and that there's an observable effect to that, that I understand. So I've already hugely improved my understanding in the last 2 minutes. So great, now I
have a comment. You said that the constraint were the laws of physics.
Well.
And now you say, well, I don't know what is the implanton. We don't know what is the implanton.
Right. That's the myth.
Really, that's not, the real constraint is not the laws of physics. The constraint is that the story has to be compelling. We are entitled to change the laws of physics
mm-hmm.
if we have a compelling story. We have to convince everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, if we can solve the problem of the universe by breaking the second law of thermodynamics, we have the right to do it. We have to convince everybody else. Mm-hmm. It's going to be very hard.
Right.
But we can do it.
Right.
The constraint is that the whole story has to be compelling.
Right. But the other thing, when I was talking about constraints, I was basically saying that there are some constraints.
There are some constraints because you're working within a tradition.
Yes.
You already made some choices to solve
right.
all the problems. You cannot go back. Mm. You cannot contradict yourself.
Right. But what you're saying is absolutely right. I mean, you have these working constraints of what we've done previously and what we know so far.
Mm-hmm.
Does not mean that we can't change them. But if we're going to change them, there's your constraint. You've got to actually be able to convince. You've got to have this compelling evidence. It's not, you can't just change them willy-nilly. That's actually what I meant by constraints. But that's an excellent, that was kind of a sloppy way of putting it, and that was an excellent way to kind of make that clear. See, this is why I need you guys. So now that we've got this whole parametric resonance thing and we've clarified these, I actually, this has been very helpful for me. I hope it's helpful for you guys too. building a story. As a writer, you know, Barbara will be able to know this. What is the backstory? Introduce us to our protagonist, the universe. You've got a little bit of a head start here because people love universe stuff. Everybody at least has been at least once to a science museum, most people. Obviously, there's some lower classes and poorer people, inner city kids that maybe haven't, but chances are they've been exposed at some point to the fact that, you know, the universe started out very small and there was, you know, a bang and it's been expanding. They kind of know that basic arc. So that kind of helps you a little bit. But you can still kind of, you know, give a brief summary of what's happened to date and what is known thus far. If you read a really good novel, they do this very skillfully and very subtly. It tends to be built into small little asides and little references throughout the ongoing story, and yet gradually you get a sense of the background and what's happened before. And that's great if you're really, really good at what you're doing and you can control the material that way. For really basic communication of the kinds of things that I think that we're looking to do, I think the straightforward kind of, you know, here's what's happened in our story so far, or last week on 24, to kind of bring people up to speed. What is the mystery? Introduce us to, you know, what you're trying to find out and why it's important that you solve the case, and, you know, what are some of the interesting clues that you've come up with so far that you find intriguing? And we've already addressed this, actually. Who is the suspect? Introduce us to parametric resonance. Everything that we talked about just a few minutes ago would work into this section. You know, who is parametric resonance? Why does he act the way he acts? You know, and then what is the evidence? Why might he be the culprit? You know, that sort of thing. I think you can see how this story kind of plays out in a very, very simple narrative. And again, you can actually get simple with just the analogies, or you can really expand it. And go into a lot of the technical details and really go into some of the interesting science. And when I was writing the Buffyverse book, I actually got, you know, fascinated by a couple of side notes, and I figured out a way to kind of weave those in. Sometimes you can do that, although I did get a couple complaints from readers. So basically saying, why did you talk about non-perturbative theory? It made no sense. But that was an example of where I kind of didn't take my own advice, and you do sacrifice something. There were some people who loved that, but I also sacrificed people who just were not going to follow me there. So we've already discussed a lot of the things that I wanted to discuss here, which was mainly, I had a lot of questions about the mechanism of parametric resonance. But that's a great idea. We've got some great analogies here. I think that we've got the makings of a really, really interesting story. But since I've got you here, let's talk about what is the mystery? What are we trying to solve, and why is it important? And that's something that it was so technical that I actually didn't know. I mean, from what I can understand, what we're trying to find out here is that there was this phase of the universe and that something happened. You had the inflation period, and you basically had those scalar fields, kind of uniform like the Tacoma Narrows Bridge, and then something happened to shatter that, and then you had the particles of the universe. How can we improve on this? How can we make this a little more specific rather than just, you know, me trying vaguely to figure out what people are saying in a highly technical talk? So this is where you guys come in. Any comments on how to explain why we should care about this reheating phase of the universe? What's it about?
Well, maybe somebody would say it would be two stars. And they might get, and you say, must the people know something about the universe? Story number one. They want the gamma and so on, but that's a big thing. They won't hurt it. That really postulated that the universe began somehow very early on. It was a hot thermal gas like the sun that did a very hot thing. It expanded and pulled off in the same. Well, that we have very good identity.
Right.
And there's the second thing, so the majority goes back to us people, food,
right,
inflation. It says that even earlier, the universe, for some reason, expanded very rapidly, except in the expansion, blew up by 10 to 100 times.
Right.
And that explains the whole sort of problem, and also gives rise to predictions that we now see.
Exactly.
But those two stories on the side we put together.
Oh, okay.
So you go from this inflation, at some point you have to get to the end of the first story, you've got to get to the beginning of the second story.
Okay, it's like the prequel.
How do you start with inflation? And then somehow there's a hot thermal dance.
Okay.
If you don't succeed in doing that, then the first story could very well contradict the successes of the second story.
Okay.
And the first story needs to be able to be consistent with the second story, which is even better testing than the first story.
Right. No, that's great, because we're talking, basically, from what you're talking about, we're talking about the prequel, and then, what happened next. Somehow, there's something in the middle here that we don't know about, between those two books. Exactly.
Inflation happened before they get around to saying what happened
to the population. Yeah, which we don't know. Right. So right here, now we've got a little bit of a backstory. We kind of know that, there was this whole story and that there's this missing piece. We don't know what happened between point A and point C. Point B is kind of a mystery, and that's what we're trying to solve. We can get as specific or as non-specific as we want. For really basic USA Today stuff or talking to an eighth grader, that's about as simple as we want to get. But we can talk a little bit about the kinds of things. We can talk a little bit about some of the evidence. Evidence, first of all, for the fact that there was a missing piece. Why we think there's a prequel. The evidence for both the things and what we need to find in order to figure out what the correct model is and get those two things to fit together. So, I guess that's another. So, what is the evidence? I've actually covered a lot of this, but I've never written about it. So, zero.
There's a theoretical puzzle, and
the end is that nothing else works.
Yeah.
But that's a theoretical one. In fact, it's more, I think, if you really ask what the evidence is, you're going to get into theories after we get down.
Mm-hmm.
But for each of us, you're ready. But the nature of the reading is what they ask, the people in this thing, ask a different question, which is also very important to emphasize. And if you look at Lisa's study, she answered the question of where do you even ask her? What's the evidence for extra dimension? By saying, I know ways of, there are ways where we can actually test it.
Mm-hmm.
They're actually asking the initial question, and the rest is not what is the evidence for whatever redeeming mechanism they can argue for, but how could we possibly test it?
Right.
Future.
Yeah, how do we get the evidence?
How do we get the evidence?
Right.
And I think it's important to stress off the environment that is, don't always have the evidence here. But
right.
Their job, and their job is not to go out and get it either.
Right.
Fair amount. But their job is to suggest ways of getting it.
Right.
And
that's actually a very good point to bring up, because most people actually don't know the difference between theory and experiment. They're extremely ignorant of how science works, and so they actually are kind of just looking for this story. So, and it's fine to answer the way you answer. Just say, well, actually, we don't have any evidence. So then you've got this nice story of people trying to the underdog detective who's got no evidence, but he knows in his gut that this is the culprit, and he's got to go find a way to prove it. So you can do a compelling story. It can be done. What I hope that you're getting out of this discussion is how we go about building a story. There's no right or wrong answer to how you do it, and different people are going to choose to emphasize different things. They're going to cast the story in a different way. They might tell the same story from a different perspective, from a different character. We might bring in tachyonic resonance, and there'll be a sequel where the tachyonic resonance tells the same story, only from his point of view. You get that a lot in literature, and there's no reason why you can't do it in science communication or science writing. So, case study number two, I didn't go to many of the LHC program, and it's just started. I'm only bringing this up because I think that you have a unique problem when you're dealing with getting media to cover more LHC stories right now, because You're all here talking about some very, very interesting stuff, but the rest of us are just kind of in a holding pattern and waiting for when you turn it on and you start getting results. Like it or not, and I don't like it, but it's true, the media is very results-oriented. They want to be able to hang a story on a paper, a new result, or whatever. One of the reasons that I started a blog was I got very, very frustrated because there were all these great stories that I wanted to cover and I couldn't sell them anywhere. I would have to work to try and find an angle that I could pitch to an editor and they would buy it. And they'd always ask, what's the news hook? Is there a paper? Is there a reason that we should care about this now? And and I just cared about it. I thought it was a cool story. So I think that's where things like blogs and alternate media can really play a role. In part, the basic story has been covered very, very extensively. There's been a lot of coverage in the science press and even in some of the mainstream media, in part because the high energy physics community is very, very good at telling a compelling narrative. They actually, if you go to the CERN website, if you look at Symmetry Magazine and some of the stuff that comes out of Fermilab and all these various groups that are collaborating at the LHC, they're very, very good at, you know, they've gotten, because they needed so much money to get this thing going, they got very, very good at selling it. You know, this is why it's important, this is how it's going to work, here's the problem that's going to solve and why it's worth, you know, this huge investment. It took 20 years, and as you all know, there's been huge slashes in DOE funding, and
Yeah.
Oh, really? That was before my...
One of the reasons we lost the SEC.
Right.
There was a community after 15 years ago, I was shocked a lot of the things. Mary was a terrible
problem. That's great.
Do you know the story of the SEC?
Yeah, I was just starting out when that failed. So unfortunately, I kind of... even though I know the story of the SSC, I didn't really understand. I knew there was a lot of tension between condensed matter and high energy physics, and I knew that Congress basically didn't see the point and just slashed the funding for like the International Space Station and it pissed off Bob Park. So that was my little tiny world perspective. At that time, I was just covering, you know, society news and things like that, and just kind of dabbing my big toe into the big scary actual science aspect of science writing. And by the way, if you wonder the effectiveness of you know, getting that core narrative and just kind of easing people into it, that's exactly how I became a science writer. If you had basically said, hey, you, and I was just out of college and said, you're going to be a science writer, you wouldn't have gotten me. I would have been terrified. I would have resisted. I wouldn't have done it. But the fact is, I got into it slowly. I got my feet wet. I got used to it. I talked to the scientists. I got comfortable. And I started wanting to learn more and asking questions and developing my skills. And I became a science writer. And it is probably the most fulfilling career I could imagine. And I had no idea it existed when I was 20 years old. So what I kind of want to bat around in the last 10 minutes or so is talk about, what are the untold stories? Because I actually think that we have a unique opportunity in this kind of holding pattern stage to maybe help prepare people, because a lot of the stuff that you're exploring is not just the Higgs. People know about the Higgs. But I think it was last year, Nature or one of the magazines did a story on basically saying that if the scientists, if all they found was the Higgs, they would actually be disappointed. I thought that was a great thing to bring up right about then, because it brought up the whole prospect of beyond the standard model physics and some of the other interesting things that might pop up there. In other words, this isn't just about finding one single particle, because that's a huge price tag for finding one particle. So they want to, you know, it was nice. So now I think we can kind of look at what some of the nooks and crannies and untold stories are, you know, some of the big personalities, some of the fun little anecdotes and things, and just try and get people, you know, appreciating just how much work went into this. Jim Wells was giving a Blackboard lunch talk, which I thought was excellent. I have high hopes for him in terms of public outreach. But he was talking about just how big it was, you know, and just, you know, how awe-inspiring it was to stand and look at just how gigantic that ring was, that it actually encircles Voltaire's home, you know, where he wrote Nasty Letters. So that's one angle that I think has been covered. But on one of the blogs, the Back Reaction blog, it's written by a couple of physicists, husband and wife team, there was an episode where they brought one of the giant magnets through the streets of the town to CERN, and she got photos of it, and she put it up, and it was ended up appearing in the local newspaper because people were just like, "What the hell is that?" You know, it was a chance to kind of talk about what that little piece was and what it does, you know, and then maybe try and put it in the broader context. A lot of people, even though the websites are good and they have all this stuff, people will just kind of, they just click. You know how people do. They just click through things randomly and they'll miss a lot. Getting a really cool, compelling picture and then using that to talk about magnets and, you know, and why they're important in accelerated physics and, you know, or detectors or various things. Rather than trying to focus on the big story, kind of talking about some of these little smaller side stories that we weren't able to talk about before because we had to focus on the core message so much. So, I guess what I want to do for the next, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes is talk a little bit about what those might be. And I've only gone to a few talks on the LHC, and I've got to tell you, they were way over my head, David. I didn't follow any of them. But I did hear a couple of things that I didn't know that I thought were interesting. The fact that there are some models where there is more than one type of Higgs boson, I didn't know that. That might be a fun little thing to play around with and come up with a creative way of exploring. That would be really, really tough, but I don't think it's impossible. I think it can be done. Pardon?
It's related to the simple symmetry.
Uh-huh. I was saying, you know, green eggs and ham,
Oh, yeah. Actually, that's a great idea. I was kind of playing around with that in my head when I was saying, well, you could actually, you know, you could maybe have identical twins or triplets or something like that. And, you know, I don't know. There was lots of different ways I was kind of playing around to play around with this idea. I was thinking more in literary terms of this idea of doppelgangers. I think there's a Jet Li movie, The One, where it postulates that there's a copy of us in all these parallel universes, and one of the guys figures out how to hop between the parallel universes and kill off each one of his little copies because he gets to absorb their energy or something. It's a great idea, you know, obviously not physically possible, but it's all these various ways of trying to figure out, you know, what if there's more than one. Electroweak symmetry breaking, I actually find this very, very interesting. I mean, but a lot of people don't even know what that means. And they don't even know that at some point, you know, the electromagnetic and the weak forces were kind of combined into one, and that there was this catastrophic breaking that happened, and they split. Not catastrophic?
That is Higgs.
Uh-huh.
That's what Higgs is.
Oh, okay.
So we're connected.
That's good to know. This is why we're doing this. Right, okay. Right. It's very interesting, though, because this is another thing. This demonstrates why it's so hard sometimes for people like me to make sense of this, because I also, there was an excellent blog post by a physicist called Why You Weigh So Much, where he talked about the Higgs, and he also talked about chiral symmetry breaking. And those are two different things. No?
Frank Wojcik and I like to argue why you weigh so much has nothing to do with it.
So, but does it have anything to do with chiral symmetry breaking?
No, absolutely. Even if there wasn't chiral symmetry breaking, there wasn't a Higgs, all the elementary particles were massive. You would weigh, you'd maybe lose 1% of your weight.
Really? So this blog post, so this physicist was wrong, is what you're saying.
Often confused. So, QCD, we had explained why you were saying, what's the way to do it?
Okay.
And all of that is simply combined kinetic energy, E equals MC squared, massive energy. So you're made out of just the energy, of course, and going rather than the ground, and combined it with. The only thing they can do is get those quarks at 2 million mass. It doesn't affect your weight or your mass.
That's very interesting.
Furthermore, you can affect
which is even better. That to me alone is amazing.
There is a confusion, which we objected of some quite unfamiliar. So Wells, for example, is very careful in what he said. maybe not that there, maybe not that explicit. So he said correctly that electrical signature breaking, the breaking of color signature, the big scenario is what gives elementary particles a name. But even massless elementary particles can bond together to give nuclei.
See, and this is why we have to have these conversations, because I know that he actually had electron weak symmetry breaking and the Higgs separately on his bullet points. So if you don't know what David is talking about here, and if you're me, you don't, you're going to think those are two separate things,
right.
And you're going to get confused because
symmetry. Well, there's no sense to them, not two separate things. They are two separate.
Yeah.
But one is a fundamental issue, and the other is how we go out and look for it, because it's the way it's implemented in the most compelling model of the symmetry.
Right. Right. And this is what I mean when I say pay attention to how I misunderstand you, because it can help you see where the stumbling blocks are. And what's, Jim's talk was general, but also general for a fairly educated audience.
But he was very careful.
Yeah.
So he was careful enough to say, as he should say, that the selective integrating core at the Higgs. To some extent, physicists tend to create this problem for two reasons. One is if you have one word that becomes the description of a whole bunch of a whole concept and a whole set of ideas, it's easier when you just call it hate.
So how can we talk about
it? And second, there's a tendency in general of expert matters and the particles to concentrate on the particles that are going to discover.
Right.
So even when they're, when much more importantly, there's a whole theory of the weak symmetry and its breaking, but what you actually, the way you verify that most often, part of the physics is the discovery of a new particle.
Right. And I think that was, thank you for bringing that, because that was the point I was going to make next. I think part of it is that, the layperson, because the LHC community did their job so well, is that now we just think that the Higgs boson is this particle and it gives mass. And I guess the best way to think about it is this is the way it does it.
This is the way it...
Like the mechanism by which it does it.
The way the elementary particles get the mass.
Right.
Through the mechanism, or electrical symmetry breaking, the simplest mechanism predicts a particle.
Right.
If you...
So there's a hierarchy of ideas. In the beginning, there were all the forces were the same.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That didn't happen.
Yeah, I don't want to go there.
That has to do with unification. Nothing.
Yeah. Okay.
That's
all the forces. Electromagnetic and weak forces are the same. And they need to be broken apart to have the world we see.
Right.
That's a bigger idea. It's a smaller idea that I
not going to do.
So think of something
about
this. Even the physicists
are
about two colors.
And actually, this is demonstrating part of the problem here. This is a James Bond scenario right here.
No, he's right. They're symmetric. They're not the same.
They're not the same.
They're symmetric.
Right.
The SU2 part
is symmetric.
And it's not in the beginning either.
But this is why it's helpful.
In the beginning, again, confuse matter. It's just, I agree with you. You want to bring it down to its core.
Right.
And it's not in the beginning. That's a whole other story. What is that? The beginning of the universe?
Right.
In the beginning,
you add that.
There's another whole story. Or in the beginning,
what you are saying is that there's electron weak symmetry breaking.
I'm just saying.
And then there's the Higgs particle. So when you put them both at the same level, you're not telling a correct story. The correct story is the simplest electron weak symmetry breaking is the Higgs. So it's only, for us, an example.
Okay.
It's not an example. It's something.
Which is why I think that the KXC program is so great, because this is the place we should be having these discussions, not during press conferences.
We don't necessarily differ on the physics, but we differ on emphasis.
Right.
Emphasis is important.
It is very important.
And,
a lot of misunderstanding comes from misguided emphasis, or what people end up getting that you didn't mean to emphasize, but for some reason they took as the main point, which is what happened to me in these talks. Very, very common. It happens all the time.
But, you know, I go to David's lectures on this, and he's always talking about the discovery of quantum dimensions of space and time. So while we're at it, before we close this out, she wants other stories that have to some options. We've got these options. Now we're going to put some more options.
Exactly.
And so this whole, in fact, people have talked about the Higgs and this stuff. Mm-hmm. But there's also supersymmetry, which is a really big deal.
Right.
That's a more important story in some ways than this.
But Jennifer, I guess you're mostly building this off Jim's talk.
Well, I had a feeling when I heard.
He didn't have time to actually get to it.
Right.
Yeah, I would. This they've heard about supersymmetry, in my opinion, is a wonderful topic. Partly because that's a really exciting prospect.
That's the beyond the standard model?
Yeah.
So far beyond the standard model.
No, it's beyond the standard model, but it is, by now, the community, if you ask anyone, including experimenters, why are they so excited about that? It's that's a Higgs is a very important. It'll come much later. It'll take 5 years, even if it's there right when we expect it. So I would like to know more about your ability to simply or some of the far about ideas like actually.
And that actually raises another thing that Sean and I were talking about over the weekend. There's been a couple of stories in the, fairly, obscure fringe kind of theories that kind of got hyped up. And so we were debating the question of, should we be talking about these cutting edge kind of things that haven't been verified? And we both agreed after batting it around a little bit that actually it's a question of balance. But yes, I think it is important that we talk about things like this, because there is this idea in people's heads that science has all the answers and that, all these various things, because we're so careful not to talk about things until they're pretty fairly well established. People are not familiar with the difference between experimental theory. They don't know about models versus what's proven. And even what's proven can be changed if further evidence comes along. So getting these kinds of things out and drumming that message home again and again can actually serve a purpose. The difference is that it has to be done extremely well and responsibly, and it isn't always. I do write occasionally for New Scientist magazine, and I love my editor dearly, but they have run a few stories that I felt were quite irresponsible and poorly done on some of these cutting-edge theories and have caused a lot of problems as a result. That's an example of one of the pitfalls of what happens when you're not ultra careful. But things like this, I think, can help address those issues. So, thank you. And I have one other. Oops. Well, we're not going to go into that because we've been talking about this, but this is what we're shooting for, a nation of Einsteins. we're not going to get there. This is obviously a utopian ideal, and not all of us are cut out to be Einsteins, and we're probably not going to be talking about Minkowski's world anytime soon. But this is what we're striving for, and if we push for the utopian ideal, we can actually, I think, we can at least get some people interested in what some of those words mean and start asking questions and being more curious about their world. So
should say four-dimensional non-Euclidean space.
I'm going to take that up with Sid. So that is it. I thank you all for coming, and I hope that you still get to enjoy your Friday afternoon.